Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Sam Sansalone, a parent advocate whose daughter Katya has been featured on the show before. He wants to describe for us the obstacles he faces again and again across the system, the government system, first in medicine and now in education, and you can probably anticipate in many other fields until attitudes change. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Okay.
I should say, sometimes multiple systems at the same time, as is the case right now.
Right.
For us.
Okay. Yeah, well, to give us a little background, what do you have going on right now in terms of commitments in your life that are impinging at the same time?
We're in the process of a move where there are some complications with that have put us in challenging circumstances where we're delayed in getting into the new house, and this is requiring us to be in a motor home. And at the same time, we were in the middle of selling some puppies that were born, and so we're here with puppies and people and problems with Katya's schooling and medical access.
In a motor home?
In a motor home. Most of the time, until we get this house thing straightened out, moving forward. Yep.
I think we got a clear picture. Recall for the listener who Katya is in terms of our show. We've discussed the problems you overcame at SickKids with getting her heart surgery after she was born. What was it, trisomy 13?
Yes, full trisomy 13, actually.
Okay.
Was the diagnosis.
All right. And she's come up against new problems, although she's probably blissfully unaware of it. What are the new problems?
One is medical, the other is educational.
Okay.
Medical one relates to her vision.
All right.
And she has developed this very, very severe myopia, and her prescription, I think, is minus 9 point something, which requires very powerful glasses. And the normal course of treatment, obviously, is simply to get spectacles. You know, you just get glasses that will help you see. But the problem with disabled children who are developmentally delayed to the degree that she is in a lot of cases, they just won't keep the glasses on, no matter what sort of manners of attachment you attempt. So this has become a problem for many such children who have the combination of severe vision problems along with the developmental delay that causes them to not keep glasses on.
All right.
What researchers have done in recent years, and in particular, there's a research center in Alberta, centered in Calgary, that has done great work in this for these kids, is they've developed laser refractive surgery to the point where it is extremely effective in correcting the vision. Completely eliminates the issue of these kids pulling off their glasses or if they fall off, you know, not being able to put them back on with the straps and all that.
Right.
So they don't have to worry if their hands or their dexterity allows them to do that or not, because they don't have glasses to worry about. And the safety has been demonstrated very clearly.
Okay.
The problem is that when Alberta, not that long ago, in the last, I guess it's been about a year and a half, switched from having multiple centers for the administration of their health care. Now, there's no regional offices. It's all done in one lump.
Right.
Huge system, serves a very large population, relatively speaking. And when that happened, a lot of things started getting cut, and budgets started getting strained. Programs were disassembled or removed altogether. And they won't tell you this, I don't think, but one of the things that was targeted was these children who have this particular problem. The vision problem that is, it's not just the vision problem, it's the vision combined with the developmental delay that makes the glasses either impractical or very difficult to use or not usable at all.
All right.
Because the kids won't keep them on or they can't get them back on if they come off.
So somebody's decided this isn't important.
Well, I think somebody's decided the kids are not important enough for their money. And not only that, but they're easy targets. And what has happened as well is that they've canceled the program, in effect, for all of these kids under the guise of there being a safety issue.
Oh.
So it's all a pretense. Because
but there is no safety issue.
No, there isn't. There is other researchers that anyone can contact in the U.S. that will collaborate the safety data.
All right.
That shows that there is not any significant or overriding safety issue at all. There are some things that could happen, as with any medical intervention.
Right.
But those risks have been wonderfully managed through further development.
Okay.
They've added other techniques or pharmacological interventions at certain stages to make sure those risks were managed. And again, this is a well-developed, advanced program. Calgary was one of the centers in the world for the development of laser refractive surgery for pediatric applications. And I asked the surgeon myself directly if the safety was an overriding factor, and he could not say that it was. I think they're put under pressure to not say too much publicly.
All right.
This is my impression. I think you should probably call these doctors, because it's not usually, or at least not always, the doctors themselves that are behind the inappropriate miscategorization of these things. It's somebody else who's looking at the budgeting numbers. The decisions were made without consultation. I tried to find out as much as I could, and I did not get the impression that even the surgeon who runs the program was part of the decision-making process to cut this program or to claim that there were safety issues. I could not get out of him that he was part of that. And instead,
right,
what I have learned is that it looks like the province, through their senior administrators, had set up this committee of physicians that were picked by them, by the number crunchers, in effect, to come up with a review that raised a safety issue that is not there, according to anything I could get out of the surgeon himself. And when I've gotten a hold of some research that's from other places over the border. In fact, is a very good source for these, and it's really clear there is no safety issue. So I think this is bogus, and that this is simply a way to save money in an environment where the government, the budgeters, the people who are struggling with the budgets, were delivered, probably very tight budget changes that have forced them to look wherever they can save money. And all the big ways have probably been used up, so they're looking for all the little, smaller ways.
Yeah. Same thing happened in Ontario.
Yeah, I'm sure it's happening everywhere. But I do believe there's a place for rationing. I am not against rationing, per se. If you're living in an envelope-funded system and you only have so many dollars, you have to ration if you're tight on your cash. But what I am very much against is when the rationing occurs on an inequitable basis, which is what I'm seeing over and over and over again. From the time Katya was born, almost within a week of her being born, to minutes before you called, in fact, to do this interview, I have experienced repeated incidents of inequitable rationing that's directed against this very vulnerable segment of the population.
And your daughter. Well, what happened just before we called?
I just received an email from the superintendent of schools for our district in Alberta, with whom I've had considerable disagreement over, even though this is the first time he's communicated with me directly.
In what period of time?
In the past, since September.
Okay.
Since, you know, near the beginning of school, middle of September or so, when these issues came up. He would always have somebody else representing him or present for meetings on his behalf or having other people email me, but this is the first time I've heard from him, and his very first sentence just is revolting. It is incredible and is reflective of the exact same Orwellian-type language I keep encountering again and again and again from the beginning to this most recent period when dealing with people that are paid by the government and have limited budgets and choose to, I believe, target these kids who are vulnerable, whose families are, you know, already so busy and strapped for time and other resources when you're dealing with a complicated child. So I think that's taken advantage of, and very few parents have the wherewithal, either, you know, in terms of their resources or maybe even emotionally, to face this kind of attack on your child's rights.
Right.
You're pushed into going with the flow. His very first sentence was a complete false statement on which his entire premise for everything else he says is based. And he claims that a decision was made to put my daughter in a school in a different district that's a segregated school. I don't want her in a segregated school. There's no reason for her to be in a segregated school. She's been very successfully placed in a non-segregated school twice in the past. There's no reason for her to be there except that it saves the money.
Right.
That's the only reason.
Yeah.
And I have learned that this district has had a lot of struggles with money. I've learned from a very reliable source that in the last couple of years they've really been having some challenges. And so, again, they're in that same situation where they're motivated to save money, and they look for, if all the big ways of saving money are gone, you try to make a collection of the minutiae and put it all together, which together makes up a big thing. And
yeah. It's odd you would have got that communication just before I called you, because
yeah,
just before I called you, I called them from the CFMU radio phone. And if they have call display, it would have come up, CFMU radio. And I gave them my name, and I asked for
Dr. Jacobs, Larry Jacobs.
Yeah, Larry Jacobs. And they said that he wasn't there. Would I like to leave a recorded message? And I said, no, that wasn't appropriate, that I would call back. And I did speak to Christensen, too. What's her first name?
Wanda Christensen?
Yeah, I did speak to her, too, and she asked.
She's the assistant superintendent.
Yeah, and she asked if there was some way she could help me, and I said, you know, I'd call Dr. Jacobs, and if I couldn't get him, I'd call back and talk to her. But after talking to her, I decided she probably wouldn't be the best person to ask about anything to do with this. And Dr. Jacobs apparently was out of touch when I wanted to reach him, but very much in touch a few moments later. So it sounds like a response to my call. I you know, that's purely conjecture on my part, but from my experience, it sounds like you got a response to my call.
And I hadn't thought of it that way, but
a very confident response to my call, since they'd avoided talking to me.
Well, that's interesting. I was expecting a response from someone. I didn't ask him anything lately because
yeah,
I gave up on him quite some time ago. I was expecting and demanding and waiting for a response from the principal and vice principal of the school, who I don't think are actually behind this. They made it very clear, and this was like quadruple witnessed, that they were completely ready to take Katya, that they were willing to do it, they were able to do it, and that it was not them that was trying to prevent Katya from attending the school.
Is it something you've taken up with the board?
With the
school
board of trustees?
Yeah.
Not yet. It was one of the things I was thinking of doing, but
yeah,
what I'd like to do is get it right up to the level where it's really coming from. And I believe that although it's sent the attempt to save this inappropriately is coming from the district level, you know, operationally, I think He's confirmed this letter that there are people actually up at the ministry level who are also behind this.
And I see.
They're trying to justify it, but as I said, the entire letter is based or you know, springs from a first premise which is completely false.
And that premise, very briefly, is?
I didn't even say that, did I? Excuse me, Josh, can you please go out there and stay with Katya? Mom should be back soon. Let's try that again. Let me get... You have to go out. Josh, can you please get the dogs out? I'm sorry. I have to start that again. I just got Rachel calling me, and as soon as she gets here, I'll have a better situation.
You felt there was no collaborative deliberation.
His very first sentence begins with the phrase, after much collaborative deliberation.
Right.
And then he goes on to describe their decision to not allow Katya to be in the school that she ought to be, as far as I'm concerned, and why, trying to justify why they would ship her away to another city.
Right.
To go to a school that I have no interest in her going. It's a segregated school.
Well, that strikes me as posing a host of problems.
Well, I should just explain, though, that there was no collaborative deliberation.
Yeah.
There was none. There was zero meaningful collaborative deliberation. I've never even spoken to this person directly, ever, and despite his being involved, and he has just emailed me for the first time, you know, a very short while ago, and there is no collaborative deliberation with anybody else either. We haven't even presented the arguments as to why she should stay or go.
Right.
It's been nothing.
Yeah.
We have an advocate, you know, AACL's CEO himself, Bruce Yuditsky, is offering to mediate some of these efforts.
Okay.
It's preliminary. There's been nothing directly with me in the way of a collaborative deliberation whatsoever. Zero.
All right.
There was an effort to initiate such on the part of someone who was going to potentially act on my family's behalf, but that was not even, you know, put into place yet.
Mm-hmm.
before I got this letter of reaffirming this questionable decision, and the whole letter is based on this first phrase that there was a supposedly collaborative deliberation. And I know why he said that. There is a reason why he said that, because even though the Alberta Education Act legislation does not specify so much the need for such collaborative deliberation before that kind of a decision is made, there have been legal cases that have raised the issue of that, the part of the legislation that provides this unbelievably ridiculously oppressive power to some school administrators and budget, you know, number pushers to look at a kid and say, you know, they're too expensive for us, we're short of cash this year, so ship them off to some place where we can process their education.
Right.
In a bulk kind of manner that's, you know, they're segregated and we don't care about that, and we don't care if the parents care about that. We're going to save money this way, and this is how we're going to do it.
There's the
legislation almost lets them do that the way it's written, because it's written incorrectly. And when I had a discussion with Bruce about this the other day, I said I believe it's against human rights just in its fundamental form. What he pointed out is that there have been cases brought to the courts which have established by precedence that there does have to be a collaborative deliberation.
I can't remember
what his words were, but it was something to that effect.
Yeah.
There is at least case precedence to fight against it.
Okay.
And what he's done here is he's begun his soliloquy with this false phrase, after much collaborative deliberation. And then everything that follows supposedly is supported by that premise, but the premise is false. The founding premise is false. There's been no collaborative deliberation.
Well, that should be easy to prove when the rubber hits the road. The problem is getting to where the rubber hits the road, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, every day that catches on at school, they're saving enormous amounts of money.
Okay.
Even if they lose this, they've already saved. I can't even count how many thousands of dollars they've already saved just this school year, and
yeah,
we're just in October.
At her expense.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, her expense, ours. We have four children. Three of them are homeschooled.
Yeah.
Katya's education herself is a full-time effort in itself.
Okay.
Because of her special needs. So we're supposed to be doing our homeschooling with our three children, which, by the way, saves the government here lots of money by homeschooling three times. you know, times three. We're at home educating three of our children to the delight of the budgeters, I'm sure. And that's not enough. They also want to try to, first of all, eliminate Katya from school during all this time since she's had two half days of school the entire school year. Oh. What is it? It's October 27th. She's had two half days of school.
Let's take a short break with John Gorka, Chance of Rain.
There's a chance of rain today, not unlike the last few days. And before then, you know, there had been a chance of snow. If you choose the carefree life, all the world in black and white, we'll have it figured out. The empty soul that has no doubt. Resistance, friction, pleasure, touch. Don't worry, you won't get too much. No obstacles to rise above. Never have a shot at love. Never getting close enough. Forget pursuit of happiness. A little break is all I ask. Each day is an act of faith. Living things are never safe. Simplicity's become a trend. Trends leave you empty in the end. They only brush across the face. But the heart is not a simple place.
You've been listening to Parent Advocate Sam Sansalone in Ponica, Alberta. They have kids, they have puppies, and they are all in a motorhome awaiting the approval of their mortgage while they're moving. Talk about trying to get his daughter into school in the district.
Right.
The entire
How did they end those half days?
Well, they had asked, after we had finally gone through the process of proving that Katya has a right to go to the school as a in this district,
yeah,
because we are moving into the district.
Yeah,
I haven't even told you the beginning of this. This whole thing started when we showed up in a town that was not familiar with Katya, and I presented her to the school. The school is very welcoming, and even I sensed excited about having Katya because she's a wonderful person and a very interesting educational case. She's expensive, but she's a good person, a delight to be around, and it's a really interesting, challenging case for an educator that got into their profession because they're interested in educating.
All right.
So it was a great start of an experience. The trouble came when Wanda Christensen, who's the assistant superintendent and directs the programming for kids with special needs, or should I say directs the budget cutting for kids with special needs is more the way I would view it, when she decided to step in and try to put an end to this. And
right.
So the school was moving forward with getting Catch registered, getting the documents ready and all that, and Wanda stomped on it and just stopped the whole thing and tried to make an argument that we don't belong here, we're not residents, that we can just go, you know, go back to where we were, basically, is what she said. She said go back to the Banff school where she was registered, and which is ridiculous because we were moving to this other city, and it made no sense to anybody except she thought, I guess, this would work somehow. And it did for a time. I had to fight them for weeks. It went up to the point of using a piece of legislation in the Alberta Education Act that requires the minister himself, Dave Hancock in this case, the Minister of Education for Alberta, it requires him to make a decision where there is such a dispute about residency.
All right.
And so after some well-made letters and communications and advocacy that I got some very nice help with, Mr. Hancock made his decision in our favor. It was communicated to us through the Deputy Minister, Curry Henke. We got the minister's decision. It was in Katya's favor. I thought that was it.
Right.
That, in reality, so that's the point where Katya started to go to school.
Right.
At this elementary school that was happy to accept her. I thought that was it, and maybe the administrators at the district were not happy about getting their toes stepped on that way.
Yeah.
And so by the time we got back from doing some more preparations for the move, there was this apparent plan in place that although it looked like Alberta Education had paved the path, way for Katya to get into school, they just had a plan B. All
right.
Along.
All right.
And it was, okay, you win, she's here, we're going to push her out another way.
All right.
They're pushing her out through this other process and trying to make an argument that she ought to be in this other school in another city that she has to be bused a long distance for and, you know, sometimes very questionable driving conditions that you get in central Alberta in the winter. And beyond that, I've read about the school and I've inquired about it, and I have no interest in my daughter going to that school whatsoever.
Yeah.
Why should I be forced to bring my daughter to another school that is not the atmosphere or the environment that I want my child to be spending so many hours of her day every day?
Because of her cognitive delays, you are interested in her social achievements as part of school and her coping skills.
Oh, no. Because of her cognitive disability, you have to balance out what is a quote-unquote appropriate education for her based on her potential, based on her limitations or challenges, I should say. You know, the process and the programming for her will be developed and will evolve as she develops.
Okay.
My understanding is the research has indicated that these kids do better when they're not in a segregated school.
Right.
Situation.
Right.
Educationally, socially, everything. Everything is better. They are less at risk when they are not in a segregated situation. the chances for abuse are increased when they're segregated. The chances for a reduced quality education are arguably increased when they're segregated. All of the measures that I have become aware of have indicated that the child is best off in a non-segregated school. And it goes beyond just the benefits to the child. Its research has also shown that the community of the school itself benefits from having this kind of integration and inclusion, so that it's a two-way benefit. When it's practiced properly and expertly, you can't just throw a kid into an inclusive environment that's, you know, profoundly disabled and expect it to just work out. Their expertise has to be applied, and the resources have to be there. It's always going to come down to the resources, because if you have the resources, they will get the best education. Research has shown it. With the right resources, they will have the best education in an inclusive environment, in a non-segregated environment.
That's a pretty good sum up of what you're hoping for then and what your argument is. Are we in a position now where you could tell us what the next steps are and add anything else that you've left out so far?
Well, literally, you caught me just after I got this very appalling and disturbing letter from the guy who is most central to this whole operation that is trying to shut Katya out of her own school district. In effect, you know, I know generally what I'm going to do. I'm going to fight this.
Okay.
Well, they have no right to do this to my child. They have no right to do this to other children. I don't know where
they have no right to do this to the children who are already in school, too, to deprive them of this. Of this breadth of experience and learning.
I agree. I agree. You know, the schools were welcoming. Katya's brief experiences, just in 2 days, you know, two half days of being there, I was already gaining this glowing feedback.
Yeah.
Both directions, about how much Katya was, you know, evidently enjoying it and getting socially connected already, and how other kids were engaging. I remember seeing, when I picked her up one of the days, there was this lovely little girl about her age who gave the warmest smile and greeting to her. It was wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I saw the certificate she was awarded, too, for being the happiest girl.
There you go. I had forgotten. That was quite some time ago I sent you that. Yes. This was in a different school altogether. We've been traveling a lot for business reasons over the last 3.5 years, and that school had taken her in without any issues like this. By the end of the school year, we got surprised with a lovely little certificate that said she won the happiest student award. I don't think it was just for the class. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
But it said Dickensfield School is what it said on the certificate.
Yeah. So. Okay. But you're moving. Are you going to encounter these same problems where you're moving, or do you know?
Well, this is where we're encountering the problems, the new place we've moved to.
Yeah, oh, I see.
We're in the process of moving to,
The outsiders, the people from away.
Right. Yeah, the problem is, I guess, we keep, with all the moves, we get to new people. So you add it all up together, the barriers that have been put up are just an extraordinary lineup for the past 9 years.
It seems you've been appointed to educate the whole province one community at a time.
I certainly hope not, but if it has a positive effect for others, that'll be welcomed. There are people who are doing a lot more for the province than I could as an individual.
All right.
for this cause. There's a lot of extraordinary work done by pretty outspoken group, the Alberta Association for Community Living. They've done some extraordinary things, and I think probably in large part because they are here is why Alberta leads, I think it leads the country, if not a large part of the world, in its application of inclusive education.
Very good. I hope you encounter some of that. And I look forward to the Association for Community Living's advocacy for your daughter and you.
Well, we'll see if it goes that way. far as I'm concerned, what's going on here isn't just about needing advocacy. I believe they're not only breaking, ethical standards for equitable treatment of these kids. I believe it goes beyond that. I think when kids are deprived of rights, when anyone's deprived of a right, and something misleading is used, any form of deception is used to deprive them of the right, that if it's done intentionally.
Oh, I see.
And
intent comes into it, yeah.
Yeah. I believe, for instance, if it's true that as so far what I've researched in this laser refractive surgery issue, if it is true that there is no safety issue, and I am certain already that it is true, and if they intentionally try to make a ruse of it being shut down because of safety issues, that's depriving someone of a right through means of deception. I'm just so sick of how much I'm seeing this from the past 9 years, and how easy it is for people to get away with it so long as they're connected with the centers of power, and the centers of power are happy to save the money, and so long as there are ways for it to be gotten away with.
Well,
I think it's going to keep happening. And I mean, Katya would be dead by now if we had followed what the system was trying to do to her. She would have been dead within a couple of weeks of starting her life.
Well, let's put this interview out there on the web and on the air, and see what we can do for Katya with it. All right?
Okay. Well, we'll give that a go.
All right. Thanks, Sam.
I'm not sure what could come of this, but I'd be happy for something good to come.
You've been listening to Parent Advocate Sam Sansalone in Ponica, Alberta. They have kids. They have puppies. And they are all in a motorhome awaiting the approval of their mortgage while they're moving. Talk about trying to get his daughter into school in the district. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the stories we read to you. Those are in the papers that we identify in the broadcast, but these are abridgments or condensations of those stories. UK welfare state takes a pounding. Deepest spending cuts since World War II include massive job losses. Last Wednesday, October 20th, announcement of about $135 billion in cuts by 2015 represents a big political gamble for Britain's fledgling conservative-led coalition government. The coalition government is gambling that the reductions in public outlays will stimulate the private sector and restart growth, rather than send the economy back into a tailspin, as liberal economists have warned. But the economist Joseph E. Stiglitz argued that the government's plan was a gamble with almost no potential upside, and that it would lead to lower growth, lower demand, lower tax revenues, a deterioration of skills amongst the unemployed, and an even higher debt. We cannot afford austerity, he wrote in The Guardian. Chancellor of the Exchequer and Britain's top finance minister, George Osborne, said 490,000 public sector jobs would be lost over the next 4 years, some to attrition. Payments to the long-term unemployed who fail to seek jobs will be cut, he said, saving $11 billion a year. And a new 12-month limit will be imposed on long-term jobless benefits, and measures will be taken to curb benefit fraud. Osborne said an increase in the official retirement age to 66 from 65 would start in 2020, 4 years sooner than planned, saving billions a year. Britain has already said it will stop paying child benefit payments to people earning more than around $70,000 a year. That from The Star, Thursday, October 21st. Byline, Sarah Lyle and Alan Cowell in the New York Times. And back in the Great White North, Red Tent Protest urges housing plan. Affordable housing advocates set up red tents in cities across Canada a week ago Tuesday to highlight the country's homelessness crisis and need for a federal housing strategy. The demonstrations were on the eve of final debate in the House of Commons Wednesday on an NDP bill that would commit Ottawa to drafting a plan. The bill introduced by NDP MP Livy Davies in February 2009 would require Ottawa to work with the provinces, municipalities, and Aboriginal communities to develop a national housing strategy that ensures shelter costs do not compromise people's basic needs, including food, clothing, and access to education. The bill passed second reading a year ago with unanimous support from the NDP Liberals and Bloc. However, efforts to ensure the bill gives Quebec the ability to develop its own affordable housing strategy were ruled out of order by the Speaker of the House in April. As a result, Bloc support may be in doubt for the final vote expected later this fall. That from the Toronto Star, Tuesday, October 19th. Byline Laurie Monsebraten, social justice reporter. Study ties drug firm promotions to bad health. A York University study shows multi-billion dollar efforts by pharmaceutical giants to get doctors to prescribe their products add 10 to 20% to Canada's annual drug costs. The study found such exposure often increased the amount of medications doctor prescribed, made them choose more costly drugs, and could lead to unnecessary prescriptions. It was released a week ago by the online journal PLOS Medicine. Pharmaceutical sales reps often offer doctors free meals and textbooks during office visits, says Joel Lexton of the York University's School of Health Policy and Management. But for the most part, this is not a bribe kind of relationship, he adds. This sets up a relationship whereby doctors view sales representatives not as salespeople, but as friends. Lexton estimates drug companies spend between $2.4 billion and $4.8 billion a year promoting their products in Canada. The costs are passed on in higher prices to patients, insurance companies, and government drug programs. That represents between 10 and 20% of the country's annual drug bill, Lexton says. And that by Joseph Hall, health reporter to The Star. Saskatchewan puts up $5 million for trials of MS treatment. Controversial therapy unblocks neck veins. The Saskatchewan government is putting up $5 million for clinical trials of a controversial multiple sclerosis treatment. It's expected that a research team will be chosen early next year and a process leading to clinical trials will be announced by April. Said Premier Brad Wall, people in Saskatchewan are spending a lot of their own money. They're in some cases raising money through bake sales and getting support from friends and families to go to faraway places to have this treatment done, he said in a phone interview. What we're saying in Saskatchewan is those people, those patients, and those families deserve some answers to find out if there's some real hope here for symptom relief and maybe something bigger. The treatment was developed by Italian vascular specialist Dr. Paolo Zamboni. And that by Canadian Press in the Toronto Star. Tim Hudak was cast as Satan's little helper. The meeting themed an Ontario worth fighting for opened with a video recalling Walkerton and welfare cuts, Harris era school strikes and hospital closures, clashes in the streets and riots at Queen's Park. Harris fled office in 2002, leaving successor Sir Ernie Eves to drive the corpse of his right-wing revolution to the graveyard. The McGuintyites as much as conceded that Tim Hudak, the conservative leader, has set the language and themes of the game, striking a chord by setting himself up as the voice of Ontario families. As a result, the Premier and his formidable clan seemed bent on reclaiming that role for the Liberals. Families have been through the ringer, McGuinty said. We stand on the side of families. Of Hudak, they said, look at their track record in government. It's a legacy of closed hospitals, countless school days lost to strikes, fired water and meat inspectors, and short-sighted schemes that have taken years to undo. And they did all that in good times, McGuinty said. Now imagine what they do in lean times. That from the Star, Monday, October 18th, Jim Coyle, the columnist. $2 million prescriptions for attention deficit disorder written for kids, a jump of 43%, about 75% of them for boys. Are we medicating a disorder or treating boyhood itself as a disease? Figures compiled for the Globe and Mail by IMS Health, an independent firm that tracks pharmaceutical sales, show prescriptions for Ritalin and other amphetamine-like drugs for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder shot up to 2.9 million in 2009, a jump of more than 55% in 4 years. More than 2 million were written specifically for children under 17, a leap of 43% since 2005, and at least 75% of them were for young males, a ratio some see as evidence that society is making a malady of boyhood itself. What if we were drugging girls at the same rate, asks John Bradley, education professor at McGill University. There'd be a march. Our penchant for the pills has pegged Canada after Iceland and the U.S. as one of the world's top three consumers of methylphenidate, best known as Ritalin, according to the 2009 annual report of the UN International Narcotic Control Board, which based rankings on per capita consumption. In Canada, research suggests that 7 to 10% of children have ADHD, most often boys. Boys are four times more likely to develop autism, three times more likely to suffer dyslexia, and 2 to 3 times more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD. While boys might be three times more likely than girls to develop ADHD, research suggests they are 9 times more likely to be sent for a clinical assessment and 5 times more likely to be medicated for it. The decline of male teachers in primary schools, Professor Bradley suspects, is partly to blame for ballooning drug use. What are we drugging? Female teachers who don't understand boys like to run and jump and shout. That's what boys do. That from the Globe and Mail, Tuesday, October 19th. The byline, Carolyn Abraham. Consultants cashed in at Ontario Hospitals, report says, money spent freely on travel entertainment. Hospitals in Ontario used money that should have been spent on frontline healthcare services and instead awarded lucrative contracts to consultants who spent freely on travel and entertainment, the province's auditor says. The auditor's findings demonstrate that Premier Dalton McGuinty has failed to impose an era of restraint within the public sector. The government unveiled new rules last Wednesday that would prevent the public sector from using taxpayers' money to hire lobbyists. In addition to their use of consultants, Mr. McCarter said 8 of the 16 hospitals he audited spent $1.6 million on lobbyists. Hospitals, universities, colleges, school boards, and children's aid societies are among the public sector entities that would also have to comply with stricter rules on expenses and procuring goods and services. Auditor General Jim McCarter audited 16 of the province's 154 hospitals, examining their use of consultants over a 3-year period ending March 31, 2010. Every hospital, from large teaching institutions in the Greater Toronto Area to small regional ones, failed to ensure that they were spending taxpayers' money effectively, he said. The findings, he said, are reminiscent of eHealth Ontario, which awarded contracts totaling hundreds of millions of dollars to consultants without competitive tenders. The eHealth scandal led Health Minister David Kaplan to resign from Cabinet and Mr. McGuinty to tighten the rules for arm's-length agencies. Quote, people are outraged at this huge waste of money that should be going into frontline health care, said progressive conservative health critic Christine Elliott. And again, quote, it's a damning indictment of how consultants made off with thousands of dollars, New Democratic Party leader Andrea Horvath said of the report. And that from the Globe and Mail, Thursday, October 21st, the byline Karen Hallett. This is a long story that we broke long before it hit the newspaper. End of life care, the death of baby Annie.
Parents seek answers about care of disabled daughter at SickKids. Barb and Tim Farlow are still looking for answers 5 years after the death of their 2.5-month-old daughter. Annie, who was born with trisomy 13, a chromosomal abnormality associated with severe developmental and physical disabilities, died in August 2005 within 24 hours of being rushed to the hospital for sick children in respiratory distress. The coroner has said Annie's death was caused by complications of trisomy 13. But the Farlows suspect the baby's death may have been hastened and question whether there exists at the hospital a culture that prevents seriously ill and disabled infants from receiving life-saving treatment. They allege a do-not-resuscitate order was placed on Annie's medical charts before they gave informed consent. And they wonder whether a narcotic was given to Annie to hasten her death, arguing there are missing records relating to a drug signed out in her name. In statements of defense, the hospital and caregivers involved flatly deny all allegations. The Farlows took their lawsuit to small claims court, but the hospital successfully argued that the case be moved to Superior Court, where it was transferred earlier this year. The Farlows say they will now likely have to drop the suit because they won't be able to afford the legal bills. But they still want a higher authority to look into the case and wonder whatever happened to plans by the province to create a complaints committee and counsel to oversee the work of the coroner's office. Recommendations to create these bodies were made 2 years ago by a commission of public inquiry, which looked into the mistakes of Dr. Charles Smith, a pathologist blamed for multiple wrongful prosecutions and deaths. The province amended the Coroner's Act 16 months ago to pave the way for the creation of these bodies. A spokesperson for Community Safety Minister Jim Bradley would only say they're coming, but couldn't specify when. The Farlow's parents of 9 other children refused to let go of the case. Barb is scheduled to address a parliamentary committee on palliative and compassionate care in Ottawa later this month. Conservative MPP and community safety critic Garfield Dunlop has taken up the Farlow's case at Queen's Park, arguing in question period that a coroner's oversight council and complaints committee should be in place to look into deaths such as Annie's. A coroner-appointed pediatric death review committee, which reviewed the case, rejected the parents' contention that necessary treatment was withheld from Annie and disagreed that there is a culture of withholding life-saving treatment for some infants at SickKids. In a report, the committee also wrote that the absence of some drug records provided even more reason for the parents to question the circumstances of Annie's death. Indeed, the parents say there is no record of what happened to a painkiller signed out in Annie's name without written authorization. Observes Dick Sobsey, Associated Director of the J.P. Das Development Disability Center and Director of the John Dossiter Health Ethics Center at the University of Alberta, there is a disconnect between what the public thinks goes on in hospitals and what really goes on. Most infants and children who die in hospital critical care units die because of a decision to withhold or withdraw care, not in spite of all efforts to ensure their survival. Many die because of a decision based on someone's idea of what their future quality of life would be, and not because they are inherently close to death. The Farlows continue to wonder if there was more to her death and continue their hunt for answers. That from the Toronto Star. Byline Teresa Boyle, health reporter. And the good news story this week, we covered this story a while ago, it's part of the news. No fine for doctor caught speeding to patient's side. A top Toronto surgeon who was pulled over by police and ticketed while speeding to save a heart attack patient's life had charges against him dismissed. Prosecutor Iwona Stamikar dropped speeding charges against Dr. Michael Kutrick after the doctor explained his automotive rush to her prior to his hearing in traffic court. Constable Wendy Drummond says the discretionary decision by a single prosecutor was not precedent-setting, and police would still pull doctors over if they are caught speeding. Kutrick issued a brief statement through St. Michael's Hospital, where he is a groundbreaking cardiologist. "I am pleased the Crown withdrew the charges. I'm glad to put this behind me and to continue my work, caring for patients." The man he saved that January day, however, was effusive in his praise of the decision.
I'm so relieved it was ridiculous, said Jeff Hallstrom, who was in court with Kutrick when the charges were dropped. Finally, a clear head has prevailed. As Hallstrom was lying on a St. Mike's operating table on January 9th, Kutrick, the cardiac surgeon on call, was rushing to his rescue. That's when he was pulled over near Bayview and Moore Avenues. When he explained the reasons for his haste, a Toronto traffic officer proceeded to write him a $300 ticket anyway. No amount of pleading would deter the officer from penning the fine, waylaying an increasingly enraged Kutrick for about 10 minutes. Hallstrom, whose heart attack was so massive that he was given just a 50% chance of survival after the operation, said he attended court to face the officer. Hallstrom did not find out the officer's name, and police would not divulge it. Hallstrom says he was angry when he learned of the prolonged pullover upon waking up 2 days after his surgery. He says his recovery may have been quicker had Kutrick got to him minutes earlier. I hope this is the start of something bigger about to happen, he adds. There needs to be some sort of change towards those types of incidents and the procedures that would happen. That from the Toronto Star, Joseph Hall, health reporter. That's all the news we have this week. Come back next week. You know there will be more. And now to take us out, John Gorka, Mean Streak.
No money coming in, it's all going out. I'm standing on the corner in the shadow of doubt. The street light's broken and my heart is gone. Fate is coming with its headlights on. I've got a mean streak, it's not a dotted line. It's a matter of fact, it's a piece of my mind. It's a mean streak, it's improved and new. Hit me once and I'll show it to you. Oh, love and money, almost the same. The less you make, the more you're to blame. The more you have, the more you desire. You cheat someone, then you're playing with fire. I've got a mean streak, it's not a dotted line. It's a matter of fact, it's a piece of my mind. It's a mean streak, it's improved and new. Hit me once and I'll show it to you. Oh, I used to keep my temper tight, right under wraps, right by my side. But now I tend to let it free when the ways of the world are getting wise with me. I've got a mean streak, it's not a dotted line. It's a matter of fact, it's a piece of my mind. It's a mean streak, it's improved and new. Hit me once and I'll show it to you. No money coming in, it's all going out. I'm standing on the corner in the shadow of doubt. The street light's broken and my heart is gone. Fate is coming with its headlights on. Although I don't know how I'll manage, I won't let you take advantage of me. Although I don't know how I'll manage, I won't let you take advantage of me.
Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.